So Luke, continuing to follow Mark, in chapter 5:27, reads, "After this, Jesus went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax booth. And he said to him, 'Follow me.' And he got up, left everything, and followed him." That's the account we find in Mark's Gospel, here repeated by Luke. In Matthew's equivalent, that's in chapter 9, verse 9, the tax collector is called Matthew. And the text continues, "Then Levi gave a great banquet for him in his house. And there was a large crowd of tax collectors and others sitting at the table with them. The Pharisees and their scribes were complaining to his disciples, saying, 'Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?'" Sinners meaning those who aren't allowed into the temple or the synagogue, the assembly of the faithful Jews. "Jesus answered, 'Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I've come to call not the righteous, but sinners.'" And Matthew adds, "to repentance." He's calling them to a new way of looking at themselves, at God, at each other, at the world. So a comment. "When Moses ascended Mount Sinai with Aaron, Aaron's sons and the 70 elders were told they beheld God. They ate and they drank. When the promised Messiah came, there'd be a sumptuous banquet to which all would be invited. Isaiah writes, 'On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, of rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wines strained clear.'" Luke, as we're beginning to see, and we'll see a lot, delights in portraying Jesus sharing a meal. Much of his teaching and a number of Jesus' parables are associated with a meal. There's some text there, but we'll pick them up as we go along. "The law had strict rules about who was welcome at the communion banquets. In the scene upon which we're reflecting, the experts in the law are shocked that Jesus eats with people of the likes of Levi and his friends. And we're going to meet this criticism later in the Gospel in Luke 15, where he writes, "All the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to Jesus. The Pharisees and scribes, as in this present scene, were grumbling and saying, 'This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them.'" And again later, "They began to grumble, 'He's gone to be the guest of one who's a sinner,'" that's Zacchaeus, chapter 19. Jesus responds to their grumbling and says, "Today salvation has come to this house, for the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost." So they've got a very different view. Jesus knew is absolutely surprisingly new and very beautiful, and full of mercy and all-embracing. But the those responsible, as they saw it, for the conduct of the Jewish community. It was all so new to them that they rejected it. You're all familiar with this lovely little scene from Revelation chapter 3. Listen, says the risen Christ in his vision to John the author. Listen, I'm standing at the door knocking. If you hear my voice, and this obviously applies to us, if you hear my voice and open the door, I'll come to you and eat with you, and you with me. So the only way to open the door is from the inside, and that's our freedom. If we open the door, Jesus is longing to come in and eat with us, as he was eating with Levi and the companions and sinners and mob that are surrounding him. The text continues. They said to him, John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees frequently fast and pray. Your disciples eat and drink. And Jesus said to them, you can't make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with you, with them, can you? The days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away. And then, yes, they'll fast in those days. But not now, not while the bridegroom is with them. Jesus is aware, as please God we are, following religious rituals in many cultures in here, I don't know about our own, but in many cultures, is kind of easy, really. Everyone's doing it, so you do it. It's a fast day, so everybody fasts. It says we like to fit in, and we're not free enough perhaps to break free. So that's kind of normal to do that. Jesus' contemporaries were good at that. Was a faster, they all fasted. It was the temple day, they went to the temple. It was the time of sacrifice. That's part of their cultural, religious life. But what they didn't know, and what Jesus is shocking them in a way, he's not intending to shock them, but what he's doing is shocking. He's actually the bridegroom. He's trying to communicate them, God loves you. It's a marriage love, it's a committed love, that's what God is. So he's looking at himself, calling himself the bridegroom, the lover. What people needed to learn was that they were loved. And in somehow breaking free of the fasting laws of the day, Jesus is almost shocking them into thinking, hey, there's something more to this religion than doing what everybody does. Just a few background texts where Mark and then Luke is drawing on this. This is Isaiah again. Your maker, your creator, is your husband. The Lord of hosts is his name. The Holy One of Israel is your redeemer. The God of the whole earth he's called. For the Lord has called you like a wife forsaken and grieved in spirit, like a wife of a man's youth when she's cast off, says your God. But with great compassion, I will gather you. In overflowing wrath for a moment, I hid my face from you, but with everlasting love, I will have compassion on you, says the Lord. Your liberator, your redeemer. Hosea, and scholars suggest this may well be the ritual, the religious ritual for a wedding that he's quoting from here. God is saying, I will take you for my wife forever. I'll take you for my wife in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. I will take you for my wife in faithfulness. And then he adds, and you shall know the Lord. Again, a beautiful married, committed image for what God wants to relate to us with. In John's Gospel, we find the Baptist speaking of himself as the friend of Jesus, whom he calls the bridegroom. Text from John 3, he who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom, that's John, who stands and hears him, rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. For this reason, says John to his disciples, my joy has been fulfilled. He must increase, and my turn has come to decrease, to move away and leave this people with their bridegroom. So he's doing the job of the best man at a wedding. It's a good image for all of us. This image holds a particularly important place in the book of Revelation. Chapter 19, let us rejoice and exult and give glory to the Lord our God, for the marriage of the Lamb has come. The bride has been made ready. This image, it doesn't happen often because it's so daring, but it is there in the Old Testament and here, obviously in the New, thanks to Jesus, this idea of God being the lover, the bridegroom, the committed lover. On the question of fasting, I hope I'm not indulging too much in this, but in Isaiah chapter 58, it's a beautiful text about the place of fasting, which is in our context, of course. And this is written by the disciples. You've got Isaiah back in the 700 BC. You've got the temple singers in exile, and they're responsible for a lot of that material in Isaiah's scroll. And then their disciples, who've come back to Jerusalem with a whole hope of a new Exodus, a new Moses, a new beginning, a new temple. It's a very exciting time for them. But most people didn't pick up the excitement. But the disciples of the temple, I'll call them the temple singers of the exile, these disciples held on to this message. And they're trying to keep it alive, but against the weight of the religious leadership, which is determined there'll never be another exile, so we'll never ever break God's law. So they became very fixed on their habits, religious habits of the law. So for example, any Jew that was married to a Moabite wife, she had to go back to Moab. No one asked about her or the kids or anything. They wanted to clean it up. And they had good intentions to do God's will. But their understanding of God was shockingly imperfect. But you've got, this is Isaiah 58. They're struggling against this heaviness. And they said, shout out, don't hold back. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Announce to my people their rebellion, in the house of Jacob their sins. Day after day they seek me. That's good. They delight to know my ways. That's good. As if they were a nation that practiced righteousness and didn't forsake the ordinances of their God. They ask me, says God, for righteous judgments, and they delight to draw near to God. That's all sounding very positive. Why do you fast? Why do we fast, they're saying to God, but you don't see? Why humble ourselves, but you don't notice? And then the response, look, you serve your own interest on your fast day. You oppress your workers. Look, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to strike with the wicked fist. Such fasting, God speaking through the prophets here, such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. Is this the fast that I choose? A day to humble yourself? Is it to bow down the head like a bulrush and lie in sackcloth and ashes? Are you going to call that a fast? A day acceptable to Yahweh? Isn't this the fast that I choose? Jesus knew this beautifully. Why the religious leaders didn't know it, I don't know, because it's here in the text. Isn't this the fast that I choose? Loose the bonds of injustice. Undo the thongs of the yoke. Let the oppressed go free. Break every yoke. Isn't it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover them and not hide from your own kin? Then, if you did that, then your light shall break forth like the dawn and your healing shall spring up quickly. Your vindicator will go before you and the glory of Yahweh will be your rear guard. Then you can call and Yahweh will answer. You can cry for help and God will say, I'm here. If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy their needs, then your light will rise in the darkness and your gloom be like the noonday. Yahweh will guide you continually and satisfy your needs in parched places. The parched places will still be there in all our lives, but there'll be a presence and a grace to sustain us. It'll make your bones strong, and you should be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail. A remarkable, beautiful passage from the Isaiah scroll, and it's obviously behind the text we're reading. Again, following Mark's comment, Luke adds, Jesus also told them a parable. No one tears a piece from a new garment and sews it onto an old garment. Otherwise the new will be torn and the piece from the new won't match the old. The old has already shrunk, the washing and all that. The new one, when it shrinks, is going to tear away at the sewing and rip the whole thing to pieces. It won't work. And then, and the women all know that, and men probably know this, no one puts new wine into old wineskins, because new wine's going to expand. And the wineskin's already old and it's expanded as far as it can go. So no one puts new wine into old wineskins, otherwise the new wine will burst the skins and will be spilt and the skins will be destroyed. New wine must be put into fresh wineskins. Very simple images, but so powerful. Jesus is coming with a new message, and you can't fit it in to the Torah, the Old Testament scriptures, as they stand. Jesus doesn't say it in Luke, he says it in Matthew. It was said to you, but I say to you. There's something new here, and it needs new. We saw this with Vatican II, didn't we? That extraordinary, spiritual, amazing gift. And it needed everything. The altar had to be turned. We didn't go full you can't do everything overnight, but everything had to be turned around. And when I was in the seminary, which I was ordained just before the Vatican Council, so I learned the way with, you know, the investments and turn your back on the people and whatever else, Latin. And our teacher of scripture, of liturgy, had just come back from Rome with a doctorate in, and he said to us in 1959 or whenever it was he was saying it, now there'll never be English in the liturgy. Oh, well, people might say today there'll never be women priests. God, there better be. But, you know, because we've never had it. It's, you know, we're so, it'll never be there. And then a year later, we've got English in the liturgy. We've got so many, but the system, and I don't, pardon me, I won't go on with this, but the system, however, we, or a lot of people, tried to fit the new wine into old skins. Even our churches, and I understand this, they were proscenium arch churches where the priest did it and we watched. That's what the that's the way they saw it. Now the new liturgy, you can't put it in a rectangular church with the altar up the front. Of course we haven't got the money to be kept in making. But people, yeah, old wineskins don't hold the new wine. And we're living at a most beautiful time of the church where the skins have been shown, that they've burst. So we've got to put our energy into listening to the new word and living it humbly, please God, and without anger and confrontation and all this. But determinedly, we all have to put the new wine into new skins. And look at this. Luke adds this, which is perfect to Mark's parables. No one, after drinking old wine, wants the new. They say, the old is good, it's better. I guess it is. But the blokes aren't going to fall for this new wine, thank you. We like the wine we knew. We like the system we knew. However well-founded and inspiring the religious customs handed on to us may be, they cannot substitute for an openness to the surprise of God's self-revelation in the present moment. That's what we've all got to be watching for. Every time a child is born into our world, a new cloth is created, and we're gifted with new wine. What will this child turn out to be, said Zechariah and Elizabeth about John the Baptist. Well, we've got a room full of people here who are a surprise and have a gift to give the church and through the church to the world. Every generation brings with it a new energy and a new revelation, not contradicting the old, but certainly not able to be contained within it. The call of Jesus is for us to be faithful to what has gone before. How? By being as open to the surprise of God's action in our lives as were our ancestors in the faith. I'm of Irish ancestry. St. Patrick, what a miracle he was. He went in there and outside the Roman Empire, the church was basically within the Roman Empire. He goes outside the Roman Empire to Ireland and somehow or other picked up the Celtic poetry, dance, art. Here am I being very proud of being Irish, aren't I? But it's a wonderful culture. It's so, many others are too, but it's very rich and very open and very dramatic and very poetic and all the rest of it. And they picked up Catholicism. They picked up the universal view of the church beautifully. God, they had some arguments with the bit like Brexit, but they had some arguments with Europe because they wanted things, the Romans like things organised, and the Irish are not into organisation, in case you haven't noticed, but it's full of life. Well, what a wonderful heritage we've got. What about now? We have to do the same. We have to be just as courageous, just as adventurous, just as poetic and dramatic and determined and loving and musical as our ancestors were, and not just plod along. Jeremiah 29, how beautiful is this? He's writing from Jerusalem to the exiles. And he says, God speaking through him. He finds these words for what he sees God wants. Surely I know the plans I have for you, says Yahweh. Plans for your welfare, not your harm. To give you a future filled with hope. And God is saying that to our church and to Australia and to our world. And thank God many are listening. If all listened, that would be so good. We're being called ever forward into a future full of hope. Our Christian faith is faith in that promised future, which God will create through us if we listen now to every word that comes from the mouth of God. In our willingness to do God's will, we must be ready to be detached from everything, however sacred it might appear. We've got the Pharisees and scribes, thank God, to witness to this. They were trying to hold on to stuff they knew was sacred. Had a long tradition. Of course they wanted to hold on to it. Sadly, they wanted so much to hold on to it that they didn't look at Jesus. Or listen to him. Then another text, again, just borrowing Mark. This is Luke chapter 6. One Sabbath, while Jesus was going through the grain fields, his disciples, isn't this dreadful? They plucked some heads of grain. Now that's bad enough. They rubbed it with their hands. Oh my God, this is dreadful. And they ate the stuff. This is on the Sabbath. You don't seem at all shocked. The Pharisees were, and they said, why are you doing what's not lawful on the Sabbath? A fair question. Don't picture the Sabbath. The Pharisees are bad people. They're really good people, but they're blind. Why are you doing something that's not lawful on the Sabbath? Fair question. Jesus says, since they're the experts, haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? No great spiritual stuff here, they're just hungry. He entered the house of God and he took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and he gave some to his companions. It's like offering communion to sinners like us. Dear, oh dear. It's very pure. You shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be welcoming. Well, Jesus didn't seem to be shocked by what David did. So why are they shocked? They were just hungry, so they had needed something to eat. Then he said to them, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. There's something bigger than the Sabbath. Now I've got to talk about the Sabbath with you. It was so important and still is so important to the Jewish community, and we've got a lot to learn from it. Judaism has survived now 2,000 years since the destruction of the temple, and Judaism is still a very rich, very small unfortunately, but very rich community of tradition. Why? Largely because of the Sabbath. They aren't dependent on a public building. It's a family thing, kept alive by mum who lights the candles and dad and all that. So it's what perhaps the family rosary, although you can't compare them, but the family rosary used to be, say for us, we said the rosary every night in our home. That practice has gone, basically, I think. But we haven't replaced it, unfortunately. We haven't had anyone with the imagination to find something. It's like a lot of things in the church. We used to fast a lot, and then the church said, well, you've got to be old enough and mature enough to work your own fast. Friday comes. Do I do anything different on Friday from Thursday? have to confess I don't. So I haven't had the imagination to do something but what the fast used to do. Little memory I have of a little boy, because I was the seventh of eight children. My eldest was a girl, Myra, and it was the wartime, and she had an American soldier coming home to take her out or something. We're halfway through the rosary. I remember this as clear as anything. Knock, knock, knock. Someone goes to the door. That's him. No one asked him what his religion was. He had to come in and kneel down and finish the rosary with us before Myra could go out. I think that's good. We knew what we wanted, and if he wants Myra, you better want what we've got. Anyhow, back to this. The Sabbath. Here's a beautiful text from Exodus. You shall keep my Sabbaths. This is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, given in order that you may know that I, the Lord, make you holy, sanctify you. Whoever does any work on it shall be cut off from the people. Therefore, the Israelites shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. Sabbath observance was symbolic of the commitment of the people to keep their part of the covenant. And every Sabbath, every Saturday, the Jewish community in eastern suburbs of Sydney and all over the place walk to the synagogue or have it in the home, depending on circumstances. They are reinforcing their fidelity to their part of this special covenant that God has with them. Isaiah 58, the same passage I just read to you a minute ago about fasting. If you refrain from trampling the Sabbath, from pursuing your own interests on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath a delight and the holy day of the Lord honourable, if you honour it, not going your own ways, serving your own interests, or pursuing your own affairs, then you shall delight in Yahweh. When the Jews at the time of Jesus, when they became, and thousands of them did, became Christians, they didn't stop being Jews, of course. They found in Jesus a new way of being a Jew, a new way of living the covenant, a new wine that had to be fitted into new skins. So while the Jews themselves would have kept the Sabbath, of course, and they thought the Gentiles would have to keep the Sabbath too, because if they're going to join a Jewish community, they've got to do that. And it was Paul and Stephen and Barnabas and gradually everybody who said, no, you don't. You don't have to change your culture to become a disciple of Jesus. You have to love and you have to believe and you have to, etc. I won't try and summarise all that. So what did the Christians do? That as it became particularly a more and more Gentile community, because most Jews, Judaism as an institution, didn't come across, didn't embrace this new way of being a Jew, this new way of living the covenant. And that was what broke Paul's heart too. I think that's the explanation when Paul talks about him, the pain he's got in his heart as he begs his Jewish brothers and sisters to, what you've got's beautiful, I know it, I knew it better than any of you, I was a Pharisee, and he goes on and on about that, but look what you're missing out in not embracing this Jesus way of being in the covenant. So what Christians did, gradually the Sabbath died out and something new came in. Doesn't replace it, it's a different thing, it's the Sunday. I'll read you from Ignatius of Antioch, the very opening years of the second century, writing to people in Asia Minor, and he says, former adherents to the ancient customs have since obtained a new hope. So they've given up keeping the Sabbath. Now they order their lives by the Lord's Day. Instead, the day when life first dawned for us, thanks to Jesus and his death. That death is the mystery that has moved us to become believers and endure tribulation to show that we're disciples of Jesus Christ, our teacher. So the day that, especially the covenant day for Christians, including Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians, was the day of the resurrection, the day of the new life, the new creation. Here's another of his letters, same man. Let no one be under any illusion. A person who excludes himself from the sanctuary is depriving himself of the bread of God. So clearly, here we have Christians at that stage not bothering, to use our terms, to go to Mass, not bothering to join the community on the day of the sun, on the Lord's Day. And he says, let no one be under any illusion. A person who excludes himself from the sanctuary is depriving himself of the bread of God. For if the prayer of one or two individuals has such efficacy, how much more powerful is that of the bishop together with the whole church, the gathering, the assembly, the ecclesia, the church. Of course, no one's pointing the finger of blame here. The church has to become such an attractive reality when it assembles that no one would not want to be there. Part of the problem today, I think, is that we're just far too slow to put the new wine into new skins. And so a new generation is not attracted. What a dreadful thing not to be attracted to Jesus and his offering of his body and blood in the Eucharist. The best Hebrews can say, and it's better than anything has been said ever since, Hebrews chapter 10, the letter written in Rome, middle of the first century, don't neglect to meet together, as is the habit of some. Encourage one another. God, isn't that beautiful? Later, the church officials decided the best way to get people to Mass was to say, if you miss Mass, you're in mortal sin. It's a pretty short dagger to get to hell. So it kind of made a fear thing out of this beautiful gathering. I don't have a lot to say about that. I have, but I won't. But we've got to make it attractive. And let's don't neglect it, but also encourage one another to be part of this community. We've just had Easter, and we've had the RCIA program going all through Australia, you know about it. I happen to know a little bit about the one in Coogee, and then four people became Catholics at Coogee, joined this community. How lovely is that for them and for us? And no doubt your parishes, please God, have a similar thing. And if I haven't, for God's sake, start it. A process of education and welcoming. Because everyone's looking. And everyone in the world, if only they knew it, would love to be at the Sunday Mass. But they have to be shown it. And that has to link with their longing. Back to our text, Luke 6. On another Sabbath, Jesus entered the synagogue and taught, and there was a man there whose right hand was withered. A lot of these scenes are highly symbolic. They're based on what happened, but they're chosen because of their right hand being withered means, in a way, you can't do anything. You're powerless to do effectively things. So we can all have our right hand withered from a whole lot of other reasons without the arm being not usable. We don't know what to do. Action is avoiding us. We're just losing our way. Well, here he is, and the scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he'd cure on the Sabbath. This is sickness, but gee, we all have it. So that they might find an accusation against him. Even though he knew what they were thinking, he said to the man who had the withered hand, "Come, stand here." He got up and stood there. And Jesus said to them, "I ask you, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? To save life or to destroy?" And after looking around at all of them, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he did so, and the hand was restored. I think if I were Jesus, pardon me, allowing me this for a minute, I think I would have said, "Come round to the sacristy, we'll sort this out later." Jesus is confronting, he won't back down, he wants to teach. So here he is saying to them, you know, they're good questions, they can't answer them, because that's the whole point. He's gone to a far deeper level than the law and its requirements. And so he gets them out and does it publicly. They, the text ends, were filled with fury. Filled with fury when a poor man who can't, is powerless to act, finds he can live and contribute. Why weren't they filled with joy? Why aren't we filled with joy? Please God, you are, but I'm not saying you're not, but our Pope has picked this up. So he's such a gift to us. He's picked this up better than any leader we've had for a long time, though they've all been pretty good. But he's picked up this mercy as being at the centre and delight. And if you see a divorced couple coming to the altar for communion, what he hasn't said as explicitly as this, because he's got a few cardinals ready to pounce. But surely he's saying you should be delighted. If you'll bear with a memory of mine that just comes to me now, I was at Kibbax Parish Priest there, and we were getting senior ministers, we called them, acolytes we called them, but publicly senior ministers, an equal number of men and women, and there was a lovely couple there. And I asked them if they'd please become acolytes as a couple. And that seemed fine. And there's a knock on the sacristy door as I was unvesting. And the husband came in and said, "Oh, look, Father," he said, we don't want you to get into any trouble. He said, we've applied for an annulment, but we haven't got an annulment yet. Now, he was thinking that was going to be a problem. And it may have been to some, but it certainly wasn't. I said, "Look, I didn't ask you to come. I didn't know any of that, and it doesn't worry me in the slightest, because you're full of love, you care for each other, you care for the community. Please do become an acolyte." And they did. And am I going on too much here? It was such a weight off his shoulder too, to realise that Father didn't mind, and not only that, was delighted in them because of who they are, not because of their situation. Like I was going to say, I hope I was right, I'm certain I was right, but they weren't. They were filled with fury and discussed what they might do to Jesus. Now, during those days, Jesus went out to the mountains. Mark has that. Luke adds in to pray. He can't stop doing that, because he's come to see the key. And he spent the night in prayer to God. That's a Luke addition to the lovely story. And when he came, he called his disciples, chose 12 of them, whom he named apostles, missionaries. And this is the list, you know, Simon, whom he called Peter, and his brother Andrew, James and John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, called the Zealot, Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Now, Judas, the son of James, in Mark's Gospel and in Matthew's Gospel, is called Thaddeus. So, what's happening here? I don't know, actually. Is Thaddeus another name for Judas, just like Matthew and Levi is the same person? Is it a different name for Judas? Or is the 12 what's really important? And naming the 12 exactly is a bit wobbly. I don't know. Iscariot, there are a couple of opinions on this. It may mean Ish is man, and Keriot is a town, so a man from Keriot. That might be his surname, place. But in Aramaic, Yaskariote Iscariot means the one who betrays. I think that's more likely. That already in his name, added later, of course, this Judas, not Judas the son of James, who is possibly the Jude that's mentioned at the Last Supper in John's Gospel, not him, but this Judas Iscariot. Jesus goes to the mountains, the place of prayer and revelation. Think of Moses on the mountain. He responds in a powerfully symbolic way to his rejection by the religious leaders, by publicly selecting and commissioning a group of 12 to carry on his universal mission of renewing the 12 tribes of the covenant community of Israel. Jesus would have loved, of course, for the leaders of the Jews to pick up this message and continue it and carry it to the world. But on the whole, they didn't. So he's left with no alternative but to choose another 12. A new community within the community, and they're the 12 apostles. He's already said that new wine needs new skins, and since the old Israel won't accept the gospel, he must establish a repentant and renewed Israel that will. The number 12, why 12? Well, there were 12 tribes of Israel. That's the immediate link. Why are there 12 tribes of Israel? Heavens, there would have been any number of tribes in Canaan, family groups and clans and so on. 12 is a symbolic number. It derives ultimately from the 12 constellations of the zodiac, which I've got there for you. Since the heavens were understood to be the realm of God in a special way, the number 12 represents universality in its heavenly aspect, the heavens, the universality as willed by God. And then the text continues, Jesus came down with them. This is only in Luke, this introductory words, and stood at a level place. And then he picks up Mark, with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea, Jerusalem and the coasts of Tyre and Sidon. They had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits, my understanding of that is those who were psychically disturbed, were cured, and all in the crowd were trying to touch Jesus. For Luke adds, power came out from him and healed them all. Jesus, like Moses, has been on the mountain in prayer with God. Moses was commanded not to take anyone with him. Jesus, on the contrary, summoned the 12 to be there with him and there to be his apostles, that they might first share with him his communion with God. And then they all come down to us. Just as Moses brought down from the mountain the revelation which he'd received from God, now Jesus with his apostles brings down the new law, the new covenant, the new word from God to, quote, a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people who are eagerly wanting to touch him and hear his healing word. By placing Jesus' words on the essence of discipleship just after the appointment of the 12, Luke wishes to highlight the universal relevance of the teaching contained in this section. A comparison with Matthew, chapter 5 through to 7, the so-called Sermon on the Mount, indicates that the following sermon is Luke's construction, composition, in which he draws together sayings of Jesus that focus on the essential meaning of the gospel and of discipleship. Luke is sharing his inspired insights into the mind and heart of Jesus in an attempt to connect with the experience of his community and to draw out the implications of Jesus' teaching for their lives. Sometimes he gives a summary statement of Jesus' teaching. Sometimes, however, he goes not to Jesus' remembered words, but to the heart of Jesus' teaching and finds his own inspired words to apply this teaching to the new situation of the Christian communities in Achaia and Macedonia. We're privileged to have here a record of a number of Jesus' sayings. We're privileged also to have the insights of an inspired disciple who's contemplated Jesus' words and with profound pastoral love is sharing his insights with his fellow Christians. Each generation is called to do the same in the context within which we live our lives, our changing lives. We won't find here an ethical code as such or a complete statement of what it means to be a disciple. The moral teaching of Jesus always includes a call, and it's this call that continues to echo through these words. We're being invited to welcome Jesus into our hearts and to live as he lived by letting Jesus live in us. And now I have to share, it's an important point. I might have to go a little bit longer this morning, not too much longer, but bear with me because this point's really important. Up till now, Luke's gospel in general, about a third of it, is taken straight from Mark, and we've seen a lot of that already. A third of it is stuff that's only in Luke, the first two chapters, for example, and the different statements we've looked at throughout. It's only in Luke. Another third, and that's a bit general, is in common with Matthew. So what's happening here? According to Origen, the earliest of the great scripture scholars from Alexandria, he said the oldest of the Gospels was that of Matthew. Jerome, the great scholar in the 400s, who went to Bethlehem and translated the Bible into Latin, the Vulgate Latin, he says the earliest Gospel was that of Matthew. And he says it's still extant in the library of Caesarea. God, the scriptures, wouldn't we? We'd give anything to find a copy of that, We haven't got it. When Caesarea was laid to the ground at kind of the library, etc., we've never found this document of Matthew in Semitic language. I'm suggesting to you only a possible thing. We've got a gospel called Matthew, Gospel of Matthew, but clearly a lot of that is straight out of Mark, and some of it's only in Matthew as well. But there's also a lot of mostly sayings of Jesus that are in that gospel. So both Luke and Matthew are drawing on some kind of source material, which is the words of Jesus, things that Jesus said. It's not impossible. I like to think that Matthew was the scribe, because he is a scribe, who wrote this down. And maybe that's why the anonymous gospel written in Antioch, called the Gospel According to Matthew, that scholar was humble and he gathered bits of this and bits of that and put his own stuff in, but he also used the sayings of Jesus from this earliest Semitic gospel. If that's right, and there's some source anyhow, that's the same source Luke is drawing on. I don't think he's drawing straight from Matthew. He's drawing on this source, which could well be the Apostle Matthew's scribal record of Jesus' sayings. Having said that, every now and then, now always in blue, I'll give you, up till now I've been giving you the Mark references. If Mark is relevant, I'll give it. But this is where you'll find the same words pretty well in Matthew. This is Luke 6:20, Matthew 5:3. And you know it. Jesus looked up at his disciples and said, "Blessed and happy are you who are poor." Nothing good about being poor. You're blessed and happy because yours is the reign of God. You're needy, you know you're needy, you're open to it. And here it is for you now, right now, in Jesus. Now present, God's gift to you. Makarios is the Greek, ashrei is the Hebrew, and it's hard to put them, and I won't go on about this because of time. Blessed is a fair enough translation, but it's not baruch, it's not actually technically the word to be blessed. It's not just the word for happy either. So I've translated it blessed and happy. Happy, as some of the translations do here, happy, joyful, because you're blessed. It's a special joy. So, blessed and happy are you who are poor. Yours is the kingdom, the reign of God. Blessed and happy are you who are hungry now. And this is not a present tense. You will be filled. Believe it. Hold on. It'll come. It might come in the resurrection, but it'll come. Blessed and happy are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Maybe not today, but you will laugh. Blessed and happy are you when people hate you, when they exclude you, revile you and defame you on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for surely your reward is great in heaven, in God. For that is what their ancestors did to the prophets. Psalm 131. O God, I am not proud. This is the poor praying. I'm not holding my head too high, reaching beyond my grasp. I've calmed myself. I've stilled my longing. I'm at peace, like a weaned child. So the child is not drinking from the mother's breast. Doesn't need to be there, but it is there, held by the mother, like a weaned child resting in my mother's arms. My whole being is at rest. O Israel, praise the psalmist, hope in God, put your trust in God, now and forever. Blessed and happy are you who weep now. You will laugh. Isaiah 61, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. The Lord has anointed me. He sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to captives and release to the prisoners, to comfort all who mourn, to provide for those who mourn in Zion, Jerusalem, to give them a garland instead of ashes, oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit. And Luke adds, and this is not in Matthew, none of this is in Mark, woe to you who are rich, you've received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you will be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all speak well of you. That's what the ancestors did to the false prophets. And Luke continues, Matthew also has this. I say to you that listen, love, here we are at the very, I don't know, the deepest part of Christian moral life. Love your enemies. And it's the first time in Luke's gospel that the verb agape, agapao, has appeared. The word love. Chapter 6, verse 27. And it's love your enemies. How profound is that? How rare is that? Because the enemy, the temptation, of course, is to the enemy to hook me so I react with as much venom and, or whatever I'm doing. He's saying, don't do that. Stay loving. It's too beautiful. Love's too important. And it's because the early Christians did it so well, I think, Christianity spread like wildfire. Because we all know that love is what matters. And Jesus says, don't let the enemies determine your behaviour. Just stay loving. And we see him on the cross doing exactly that. And what's he mean by love? It goes on to say, do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. So it's not an emotion of liking, but it's a fidelity to do good, to bless, and to pray. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other as well. And from anyone who takes away your coat, don't withhold even your shirt. Give to anyone who begs from you. And if anyone takes away your goods, don't ask for them again. Do to others what you'd have them do to you. So profound. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. Love your enemies. Do good, lend, expect nothing in return. And here he comes. Why can Jesus say all this? Your reward will be great. You'll be children of the Most High, for he is kind and to the ungrateful and the wicked. He wants us to behave like this because that's his image of God. God doesn't have enemies. God loves, so you do it too. That's his image. Now, without that image of God, of course, none of this makes sense. With that, it all makes sense. And Luke concludes. Matthew says, be perfect as your Father is perfect. And that's very beautiful. Meaning the kind of perfection you're looking for is the perfection of God, which is the perfection of love. Well, Luke translates that for his non-Jewish readers and uses the word oikotiromos, merciful, which only occurs in this text and in James chapter 5, verse 11. It's a rare word, but it's a compassion. It's a beautiful, it's written in the Old Testament scriptures. It translates rahamim, rahim, the woman's womb again. So have this feeling the way your father is. Your father hyphen mother has this womb bearing you in her womb to bring you to fullness of life. A very rare and therefore precious feminine image of God in a language that is largely male. And it's not bad that it's largely male, but we want to see these beautiful texts that Jesus sees. Don't judge and you won't be judged. Don't condemn and you won't be condemned. Forgive and you'll be forgiven. And I conclude, give and it will be given to you. None of this is in that one line is, but none of this is in Matthew, none of it's in Mark. This is Luke material. Give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For the measure you give will be the measure you receive. It'll take 2 minutes. Can you be okay with a bit of music?